Welcome to Through the Eyes of Women, a program featuring the lives and perspectives of women, local, national, and international. You're listening to Through the Eyes of Women here on KHSU. I'm Danielle Orr here with Brenda Perez. She is a researcher and PhD candidate from the National University of Mexico.
Mucho gusto.
Mucho gusto.
And we're talking about observations in cannabis. So tell me how you got interested in the cannabis situation and plant.
My interest began when I was looking for answers for the war on drugs in Mexico, and I decided to understand this process by looking at the plants that are penalized there, by looking at the growers that are in the jail, in prisons because of this. What I did to better understand is to study other plants as the coca leaf to go closer to the organization of the growers in Latin America. Then when I make this jump to the cannabis in Mexico, I just discovered that it is impossible just to be closer because the plant is surrounded with such a criminal activities over there in the last years that for a researcher to go closer, it could treat your life. Like, it's very dangerous.
Yes, it's dangerous. Mm-hmm. And so you are a researcher. When you started to be interested in the war on drugs, you were a student where?
I was studying Latin American studies at the National University in Mexico as a master's degree with the coca leaf. And then in the PhD, I decided to understand better the cannabis production.
And so you were interested in the plants as a cultural aspect to the people in Latin America, starting with coca leaf and what else?
The coca leaf, the peyote, and the cannabis.
Peyote.
Yeah.
And so these are indigenous plants used by cultures, and then a war on drugs with governments and the use and sale of those drugs.
Yeah. I just find very unfair, very criminal to criminalize people that grow these plants that have been used for, in the case of the coca leaf, for 9,000 years over there. In the case of cannabis, the special region I studied, Michoacán, there is the most ancient plant is the 17th century over there.
And what did they use the coca leaf for?
It was used as a source of energy because it has so many minerals and proteins itself. So for the people that was like messengers that were traveling long distances, they always have the coca leaf with them. It has, for example, a high content of calcium. It's really something also to manage the highness because there is the altitude is very, very extreme over there. Mm-hmm. And so with this plant, you can oxygen better the blood and you can go and make physical activities in a better way.
And they use the coca leaf, right? To just chew on it?
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
They chew on it with some alkaline material.
Okay.
So to potentialize it. And so you just put it there. You put it in the side of your mouth.
Okay, in your cheek.
And you just kind of swallow all the juice of the leaf.
And was this used for people of all ages? Was it just for grown-ups, adults?
In the field, when you see the people, the families growing, you can see since the children are chewing until the older. So, I mean, the youngest I saw working in the field was 7-year-old maybe, mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then peyote, what was that used for historically?
The peyote, my experience was in this region called Wirikuta in Mexico, and they made it for a religious travel journey for communicating the dreams. This is the dreamers group, and they are also well known because they travel a long distances for having this biannual meeting for finding the deer, for hunt the deer, mm-hmm. which is a peyote. Mm-hmm. And they reunite around the fire after the hunting. They eat peyote collectively, and then they connect with their dreams and their hallucinations as well, mm-hmm. about what they are going to do or what they did before. It's a space for healing also in collective way because in front of the fire, they all ask forgiveness for any fault they made before.
Mm-hmm. Well, and as far back as we know, even the gorillas and chimpanzees use the plants in nature to treat themselves for all sorts of things. Humans are no different. We've been using plants, and these are just plants.
Exactly.
And so this goes back as far as we go back, and probably before that. Where was the crossover where these cultural rituals and cultural use of these plants became criminalized? Where was that jump?
In Mexico, it's earliest laws against marijuana, for example, around the world. It was the 1920s when they start to say, no, we don't want this. Even before the 1914 here law, Mexico, they was discussing that because they relate the marijuana with the indigenous population all the time. And they want to have control over this population that were unhappy with the regime. And so that's why they create prisons or these houses for people that consume marijuana and start these laws, very, very like repressive laws against it. I think it's related also with, in Mexico at least, it's related with a certain group of population, the youngest people, but also with woman that was penalized for using, for healing, the so-called witches, for example. For the Inquisition, it was penalized to speaking about marijuana. They call them in a Nahuatl way, the pipilzintli. The historians here are going to be divided if the pipilzintli was the marijuana, but most of the books say it's like, yeah, and they call them that way because they discovered the healing uses, but also like the hallucinations with other plants and the religious cosmovision around.
Wow, fascinating. And so marijuana also in Latin America, it was grown there as well?
In Mexico, where I know, is that arrives with the Spanish when the conquerors, they bring it from also a long tradition from Asia. Like the plant is traveling around. It arrives from Asia to Spain, Spain, Mexico. Around Mexico, the Spanish always try to grow the plant for having the hemp, the fiber for the boats. They make a big, big impulse over the plant. But very soon they discover that the population start to use it in another ways and they start to criminalize the plant.
Wow, fascinating.
I know, I love it.
Okay, so you studied all that and then you got your PhD.
I'm working on my PhD right now.
Okay.
I am comparing the production of cannabis in Michoacán and in Humboldt County. It's the Emerald Triangle over here and the hot land over there. And so how in such a different conditions the plant is surviving, I want to try to demonstrate how is working out the organization of the growers to face, well, here I suppose legalization in a certain way and there illegalization. So it's two different and very polarized context, but the growers are always, you know, under the fire in a certain
and so
way.
It was its criminalization that you're studying particularly. So how did you hear about Humboldt County and Michoacán?
Well, that was interesting. There was a pattern of migration already from Michoacán to California. This is like one of the biggest population here is the Michoacán in California. First, second, they told to me about this place where people goes every year. But this is like, you know, the hippie club in Mexico that came to Humboldt County to trim. And then and the next year I decided just to come and see what's going on. And it's true. I
did you get funding from your school? I mean,
the first time I came, I just came by my own because I couldn't, since I didn't find a source that allow me, like it looked very informal for my university to, okay, go see how they trim or something in the summer, you know. And so I decided to do it by myself. And after that, I just present a very nice project that they support and they found me to come back the next year.
And you came directly to Humboldt County. When you say people come, is it all through the whole state or is it mostly in the southern part? Do you know?
It's in the southern part, mostly Mendocino, I must say. But for I choose Humboldt County because other group of people in Mexico City was coming every year since 10 years ago.
Yeah.
So they told me about, well, Humboldt County is maybe more mellow, maybe more nice. And if you want to just introduce yourself, go Humboldt County.
The people from Michoacán, do they go home every year? Do they just come for a little bit of time and then go back? Or
what happened is they stayed. A long time ago, they just decided to stay because of the war over there. Mm-hmm. So there is no more conditions for people to being there and growing or being there and living. Like, it's impossible. I've been observing with my own eyes processes of harassment, criminal harassment over families and how these families decide just to come and ask for refugee in the United States.
Okay, so the criminalization of the use of drugs in Michoacán, for instance, what are some of the differences that you have noticed here?
Yes, well, over there, the institutions are very weak and very corrupted. When I say this, I am thinking in the police and the army that is involved of the security over there. And what happened with criminalization and growers, it's when you get arrested, you don't know if you are going to appear, for example. Your family is not sure where they are going to send you or how is you going to be your legal process. You have no guarantees of anything.
So it's a very serious crime.
It is a very serious crime, and it is a very serious way the institutions solve this crime. Like everything, it's like a spiral of violence. In one way, you are criminalized because you are growing drugs, but when you face law, the law doesn't assure you have a legal process, a right legal process. When you come here and you see asylum presence, people that is being arrested, at least you know where they are, how is this going to happen. You know, they have access to a lawyer. It's a different way to live with the subject. Mm-hmm. In Mexico, there is just no tools, no legal tools for growers to face this problem.
And that is because you mentioned it's a way of controlling a population, or is it because of sales of drugs? Is it, you hear this, you know, the war on drugs here and the war on drugs there, lots of crime. Is it the same thing? Lots of crime comes into it. Is it really just because of the drugs and sales of the drugs, or is it some of the criminal activity that goes along with it? What about that part?
That's a good question. I think the war on drugs is, at least in Mexico, is a strategy for controlling territory. What I'm saying, when I'm thinking when this starts like officially, like the war on drugs, it was 2006. In that year, the government of the United States and the Mexican government signed what they called the Mérida Initiative, which is sending a lot of money for the army and the marine for controlling the transit of drugs. What happened in real when they enter the marine and the army, with they are not supposed to lead with population. They are supposed to lead with other armies. When I'm thinking in a war logic, the army supposed to defend the territory, or historically, traditionally, not
defend the people of the territory and the territory. Yes.
Exactly.
Okay.
Not defend something against
themselves.
The population.
Yeah.
You see, there is no logic on that tactic. But anyway, the Mexican government went after that. And when they get inside the territory, they just make occupation, military occupation of certain strategic pieces of land. For example, in Michoacán, that coast, the Pacific coast that was controlled by army, was very soon corrupted and allowed the entrance of precursors for producing MDMA from China.
Oh.
And that was super, that was a scandal because the army allowed this, like there was potentially 10 times more entrance of precursors over there for producing MDMA that come to the United States. And that was another change in Michoacán, because a region that was traditionally marijuana grow, then they were producing methamphetamines, like synthetic drugs, and with all this pollution that it results in the rivers, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a big change.
Really,
after
you can study every subject on earth if you just start with the drugs.
Exactly.
It goes to politics. It goes to so many.
I think so. If you just start with the drugs, it's going to lead you to human history in so many levels and understanding different cultures as well.
And so we know there's corruption everywhere. Why do you think it became so corrupt in Michoacán or in Mexico?
Wow, I want to say like a social crisis, but also a governmental crisis. The institutions has no credibility. Why they went so corrupt? I think it's a lot of money, like big time, big interest. We are surrounded by China that is controlling the Pacific, but the United States in the north. And we are just, for example, receiving all the migration from Central America as well. So this is all these factors combined make that a weak government, failed very easily when they don't have a clear vision or what is right as a public policy, as a policy in general.
Yeah. So you come here. Let's talk about that a little bit. So you arrive and you start meeting people, and give us some of your observations, if you would.
Yes. I came here. I introduced myself as a student. And so the people in the farm that I visit received me very well. It was such an interesting farm because the mix over there was people mainly from Mexico, but also from Europe, people from New Zealand, and it was so interesting for me. One of the things that made me worry at the beginning was how far this was inside the country. I mean, when I first arrived to Arcata and I reunited with a group of people that was going there, I just started watching in the car how the city was disappearing, and then the redwoods, magnificent redwoods. But I wasn't aware when we were going to stop. We traveled around an hour and a half inside the nature. And I was like, wow, okay. And there is no signal in the cell phones. There is no way to communicate. My English was less advanced than now. I was practicing less at the time, so I was barely speaking some words, like the basic words.
And like, where are we going?
Yes, I was like, okay, I can't leave signals in the street because I don't know where am I going. I'm just going, and I was just trusting in people inside the car. And well, the farm. First thing I always remember is this smell. The strong smell to weed, like, oh, yes, this is cannabis land because it's in the air. And then when I just saw the plants, that was for me amazing, the way they have it in pots, for example, when I was used to see it on the earth.
And let me tell everybody, you're listening to Brenda, PhD candidate and researcher, and I'm Danielle Orr. Please go ahead. So you saw the plants in pots instead of in the ground. Bigger, as big, same as, different?
Not as big as I knew them before, but in a very aesthetic shape. Like they were all like a nice...
Manicured.
Manicured. Yeah, that's the word, manicured. And I was amazed. Like, wow, these people really take care of these plants. Okay. And so they showed me the trim room, for example. I was amazed how I can touch the plant with my own hands. And then they teach me how to don't hurt the plant of the crystals they have. So it's better for the producer to sell it. They show me the shape of the scissors. There is a method. There is a very advanced way to do it. And they show me different strains and how they want to make them appear after the trim.
So is that different in Mexico, the way that it's processed?
I never saw that process. I saw the plant in the ground, but I never saw the trim, for example.
Okay, because you didn't know anyone, or it's more secretive?
After the harvest?
Yes.
That's secretive. Like, who knows who makes that?
Interesting.
Yes. What I see in Mexico City with the high class, for example, that they have the buds. But, you know, in Mexico, it's not as usual as we think to see the flower. We see more the pieces, like all grinded.
Okay.
What I see here is...
It's like the wine industry.
Definitely, yeah. Definitely. Yeah, I also learned to distinguish between different strains because of the smell, because of the size, because of the leaves, the shapes of the leaves. So that was all for me, like, precious knowledge. Like, wow. That was also for me like a point of depart for appreciate the plant even more. Mm-hmm. I knew the plant was precious historically, it's medicine, but having it in the, like, see different ways of it, powerful, and the differences are beautiful, that I just really start having this special connection with the plant in another level.
All the plants are beautiful. Every plant is beautiful. So then there's that point of departure where it becomes a criminal activity, and so
yes, it is very sad for thinking that, as you say it. I mean, when I see it in the pots or in the ground, I see how this plant can be like under prison, under jail, and as well the producers, you know, how the people always that works with the land, they are the last in the chain, and they are the most punished always. It's not coca leaf, peyote, marijuana, opium, etc. It is very sad for me to think about that. Also to think how For example, now they are in Christ and they are the, also the last and the most unprotected by law. Like they have to close the farms, for example. They just have to sell the production for a very low cost. That's something to think about.
Mm-hmm. Has this perspective changed your research?
Changed it dramatically. I came and thinking, wow, this is very unfair that in Mexico we have the war on drugs and in the U.S. we have almost like the fine wine party, you know, okay, about weed. But when I came and see closer, I said, like, no, this is not as black and white. And this is not as it is. There is people that have an appreciation about the plant. There is people that has even a thought and a culture around the plant. There is people, I will always remember my school in Honeydew, for example, when the family is saying, we want to see this as a happy plant, as a medicine. And they were watching long time the plant like it. So my perspective changed. This is not the industry I thought, like the cult industry I thought. I see people as cultivators, as a handcrafters of the plant, as people that has included the plant as a way to communicate.
So do you see this criminalization as it's the same thing as in Mexico, where it's against a certain population of people, the farmers, the land, counterculture? It's the same thing.
It is. What I observed here, I didn't know, was, for example, these special task forces against the producers. That was, for me, a new discovering. Okay, like now I can make connections instead of just contrasting. I can make connections with California and Michoacán, and I can study how similar as is the resistance for growing a plant. I can't also think how the, as you say, as the counterculture has served in so many ways to resist, to make community, to think about the plant, to appreciate it.
Mm-hmm. Do you still see the plant as medicine?
Yeah, definitely.
Is it still medicine in Mexico?
It is. Mm-hmm. It is. There is very, very, very long old tradition with the plant. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, so many medicines, I mean, I don't know if you've noticed this since you've been here, but people take a lot of medicine in the United States, I think. And those are synthetic medicines, which were created from the plants. I mean, that's how they decided what to synthesize, right?
Yeah.
So what's the difference there? You have something to say about that difference?
That's a very interesting question, very important as well. I was thinking when I was in Michoacán, observing this process of the synthetic drugs production and how the consumption wasn't as high as it is in the United States, for example, I was considering, okay, the patterns of consumption of drugs or any other product are determined by society in so many ways, or maybe as the institutions, the oppressive institutions, I must say as well. This urgence that I've been observing here, for example, of being the first, the best, you know, like superior maybe, or this constant pressure that has people in being, wow, the best, it's making them like hurry and, yeah, making them and hurry consume something, you know, whatever it is.
Interesting.
In Mexico, there is more relaxation about, like, seriously, like, no, we can fail. We learn.
Uh-huh.
I think that's a change.
And so not as much drug use.
Not such as much, no. That's interesting also in...
Do you see it as big business here? Is it a business? It's such an interesting perspective. So we're pressured to perform, and it's not like that in all places in the world. And so you think that's partly why we use so many drugs?
Uh-huh. I really think so.
Yeah, fascinating.
One professor of medicine says, I don't know if this is true, but the society in the United States, it's very connected with pills, with medicine, because they have a low resistance to pain. You have a little pain, you really have to, you are afraid.
Yeah, you need a pill.
Need a pill. Like, not,
you don't
right
want to feel anything.
No, you really want to be in this sedative way of thinking or feeling.
So you can keep performing.
Yes, is it? In a best way.
Okay, so interesting. Back to your observations here in California. So you've now entered into a relationship with the cannabis industry and the criminalization, let's talk about that a little bit. So the criminalization aspect, from when you're with the plants to then, what did you start to see?
Well, for example, a very early call of attention for me in that subject was when I was in this farm that I described, the first one I visit. The cops arrived. There was like a special...
Just out of the blue?
Yes, it was, I think... People explained me that there were several marijuana farms around, and the sheriff arrived with some papers, a warrant, they call.
Okay.
And everybody runs and hides. So okay. I was like, whoa, okay, well, my university didn't even know I'm here. Oh, my God, I was such in a panic.
Yeah. And had you ever had an experience like that in Mexico?
Never.
Never. Okay.
Never. So I was like, okay, oh my, oh, this is a plant under control.
Yeah.
I see. I was very naive, maybe thinking like, oh yeah, this is very mellow. No, there is control
okay,
and there is police around.
Yeah.
And what happened is the police stopped in one farm before the one where we were because they find a group of women in bad conditions, working in a bad conditions.
Okay.
Women. So, but we all leave that farm, like the next day we didn't spend the night in that farm.
Mm-hmm.
So we just spread.
How did you feel about your working conditions?
The working conditions in the farm I visited was good. Very nice treatment, very nice conditions, like very nice food, different food, vegan food, for example. I didn't know even what was a vegan. So it was a vegan menu, and then the veggie menu, and then the meat menu. I was like, whoa, okay, fine. So I try vegan food, it's good. I enjoy it.
And then what happened?
Then somebody told me like, hey, you know, you want to go to another farm. Somebody invited me to another farm. That was the Honeydew Farm. And that was so special. And that's when I was like going more into the people. Because in the first farm, I developed more into the plant, but in Honeydew, it's just the ambience, it's the environment. It's special, it's nice, it's magic for me, like really. And the people, it's very close to my heart, I must say.
Mm-hmm. So it's so fascinating. It's a perfect place to stop, and we'll continue this conversation. You are so amazing and so interesting, quite a bright star.
Thank you. It's really nice
that you're here. And you are Brenda Perez, and you are studying from the University of...
The National University of Mexico.
National University of Mexico, PhD candidate, and we're talking about observations in cannabis. We'll do this again, part two.
Of course.
Yes?
Thank you,
okay.
Yeah.
Hey, to stop.
Me too.
I'm Danielle Lori. Been listening to Through the Eyes of Women. Through the Eyes of Women is produced for KHSU, located at Humboldt State University. Thanks to today's wonderful engineer and editor, Jesse Eden, and to our entire Through the Eyes of Women team. You can listen to this show again anytime at Through the Eyes of Women's blog at khsuwomen.com. Join us again at 1:30 next Monday here on KHSU.